We interrupt this broadcast. In the pre-dawn era of electronic media, late-breaking news was communicated by street-corner vendors holding freshly printed stacks of late-edition papers, shouting, "Extra! Extra! Read all about it!" Yet in the time it took to prepare and print the special edition, the story was often dated before it ever hit the streets. But with the advent of radio and then television, breaking news could be flashed instantly into our homes, offices, and automobiles. Late editions gave way to bulletins, and shouts of "extra, extra" were replaced by a phrase that has come to command our immediate attention. It's a phrase so powerful that Orson Welles used it to make his famous War of the Worlds broadcast absolutely believable. It's a phrase that evokes a few heart-stopping seconds of anxiety between the interruption and the actual announcement of what has happened. It's a phrase that puts us in the moment. We brace ourselves as we wait to hear the news that follows those four chilling words. We interrupt this broadcast.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency...
We interrupt this program to bring you a news bulletin from Washington. The White House has just announced...
Here is a news bulletin. Shots have reportedly been fired.
Here's another late development, and this news keeps coming in.
This is an NBC News hotline report.
Special report. Verdict sparks violence. National Guard troops are standing...
We interrupt this broadcast. The sounds and images have become part of our very memories, and in turn, defining moments in our lives. We remember forever where we were when they happened, and how we felt when we first heard the news. Each event is presented as it occurred, allowing you to be in the moment again, or perhaps for the very first time. Prepare to relive the events that have changed our outlook on the world forever, as we interrupt this broadcast. Before and after December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii has beckoned visitors to an island paradise in the Pacific. But for 2 hours that morning, it was the site of a sneak attack that changed the course of world events. From that moment on, the name Pearl Harbor would be linked forever with those events, and an unforgettable day that will live in infamy. By mid-1941, the Japanese government had decided that war with the United States was inevitable. Even while peace negotiations continued, plans were being made to launch a preemptive airstrike against the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, home base of the Pacific Fleet. Sunday, December 7th, dawned across the rest of America much like any other day.
Our reserves are limited.
The nation's radios were tuned to NBC's religious program, National Vespers, or the New York Philharmonic over CBS, or the football playoff between the New York Giants and Brooklyn Dodgers on the Mutual Network. Then came the news that would shock and unite this nation like no other event in our history.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned to WOR for further developments.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special broadcast.
Here's the bulletin. Washington, the president decided today after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila to call an extraordinary meeting of the cabinet for 8:30 p.m. tonight and to have congressional leaders of both parties join the conference at 9 p.m. And now we take you to Honolulu.
We have witnessed this morning...
The attack on Pearl Harbor left 2,335 Americans dead, over half of whom perished when a bomb dropped from a Japanese fighter plane detonated the ammunition supplies on the battleship USS Arizona. There were more than 1,000 wounded, and dozens of U.S. ships were destroyed or seriously damaged. But if Japan had hoped to obliterate U.S. opposition by its attack, the results were just the opposite. Shocked and angered, the country united behind President Roosevelt's decision to declare war on Japan.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
The day that will live in infamy became only the first of many, as the United States entered the most devastating global conflict in modern history. It was the biggest overseas military operation in the biggest war in world history, D-Day. Plans by the United States and Britain to invade German-occupied Northern Europe had been in the works for nearly 2 years before the summer of 1944, when the supreme commander of those Allied forces, General Dwight Eisenhower, gave his assent to begin a massive landing at the French coastal town of Normandy. Those still awake in America and listening to their radios in the wee hours of June 6, 1944, were most likely listening to the harmonic band of Leo Diamond and his Harmonaires when suddenly, at 12:41 a.m. Eastern Time, the broadcast was interrupted with the first news of the invasion.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency, Transocean, said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
Within hours, official confirmation of the invasion came in a broadcast transmitted from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force in London.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
The landings were a tactical success, as Allied troops gained their first foothold in France since the beginning of the German occupation of that nation 4 years earlier. Less than 3 months later, on August 25, 1944, Allied troops liberated the French capital of Paris. Just before 9:15 on the morning of August 6, 1945, three U.S. B-29 bombers, the Enola Gay and two escort planes, flew over the city and dropped its cargo, a nearly 9,000-pound atomic bomb. 30 seconds later, that bomb exploded 1,850 feet above Hiroshima in a blinding, searing flash of light and heat.
The White House has just made an important announcement on the war. And to bring you this story, we interrupt our program to take you to Washington.
I have just returned from the White House, where it has just been announced that the United States is now using an atomic bomb, the most powerful explosive yet developed. At the White House, Eben Ayers, presidential press secretary, released a statement by the President of the United States on the atomic bomb. Here is President Truman's statement.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
An estimated 80,000 people died within the hour, more than a third of Hiroshima's civilian population, while tens of thousands of others would perish from burns and radiation poisoning in the months to come. Thank you. On October 4, 1957, an intercontinental ballistic missile, launched by the Soviet Union, hurled an aluminum sphere into outer space. The satellite weighed about 184 pounds and measured a little less than 2 feet in diameter. It had two radio transmitters, which elicited regular beeping sounds as it revolved around the Earth. It was called Sputnik. The stunning accomplishment was broadcast to the world in English from Radio Moscow.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR. According to preliminary information, the carrier rocket has imparted to the satellite the required orbital velocity of about 8,000 meters a second. At the present time, the satellite is describing elliptical trajectories around the Earth. Its flight may be observed in the rays of the rising and setting sun with the aid of the simplest optical instruments, such as binoculars and spyglasses.
The Eisenhower administration was quick to assure that the Russian Sputnik posed no threat to U.S. national security, but its psychological effect was immense. For the Soviet Union, seemingly lagging behind the United States in its technological capabilities, Sputnik provided a dynamic boost for morale. For American citizens primed to believe the worst after a decade of Cold War fears, Sputnik created new worries about the extent of the Soviet Union's military power. While perhaps suggesting a silent rebuke to the material comforts of America's 50s consumer culture. Early in his term as president in 1961, John F. Kennedy's vision of sending a man to the moon struck a popular chord. Instead of an arms race with the Soviet Union, that threatened world peace. For a generation that had grown up watching science fiction fantasies on movie screens, on May 5, 1961, Navy Commander Alan Shepard became the first U.S. astronaut to rocket into space. He hurtled over 115 miles toward the heavens and parachuted back into the Atlantic Ocean about 15 minutes later. Then, on the morning of February 20, 1962, John Glenn became the first U.S. astronaut to be rocketed into orbit around the Earth.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, the clock is operating. We're underway.
Loud and clear.
Roger, we're programming and roll okay.
Roger, zero-G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
Three orbits and some 4 hours and 56 minutes after launching, spacecraft Friendship 7 splashed into the Caribbean, about 50 miles from the waiting destroyer NOAA. Soon John Glenn came aboard the recovery helicopter, smiling as he had smiled indeed all the way.
It was quite a day. I don't know what you can say about a day in which you see four beautiful sunsets in one day, but it's pretty interesting. Wondering what effect zero-G would have. This puts us into a new environment that we have had no experience or limited experience with before. I recalled last night when we were discussing some of these things, the fact that I had had this little hand camera once, and I had taken a picture, and I wanted to do something with a switch immediately. And it just seemed natural at that time, after I'd been weightless for, I guess it was a half hour or 45 minutes, I had acclimated to this rapidly enough that it just seemed perfectly natural. Rather than put the camera away, I just put it out in midair and let go of it and went ahead with the switch position here and reached back to the camera and went on with the work.
John Glenn successfully orbited the Earth three times, manually controlling his capsule for much of his journey, before re-entering the atmosphere and plummeting safely into the Pacific Ocean. In one day, he had seen four sunsets and ridden into one as an American hero. To her third husband, the playwright Arthur Miller, she was champagne on the screen. But off the screen, Marilyn was a mess. Despite her own effortless luminosity, she sought refuge in the reflections of others, leading to unsuccessful marriages with Miller and with baseball star Joe DiMaggio, and rumors of an affair with President John F. Kennedy. On August 5, 1962, Marilyn Monroe died alone in her apartment from an overdose of sleeping pills.
Hollywood itself, stricken by the loss of its golden goddess, was often pointed out as the villain of the piece today, as from all over the world came comment and speculation as to how and why Marilyn Monroe died. One of her co-workers was the director-producer John Huston, last to pilot her through a film, The Misfits. And in London today, John Huston said,
"A number of those who were close to her during the making of The Misfits thought it would be only a few short years before she died or went into an institution. Her great enemy was sleeplessness. Only God knows why she feared it so much. Perhaps it was simply that not to sleep meant losing her beauty, but I'm inclined to think that there was more to it than that. In any case, she fought her enemy, consciousness, with sedatives, until she'd achieve not only sleep, but insensibility. Then stimulants would be employed to awaken her. This vicious circle played such havoc with her body that she had to be hospitalized for 10 days in the middle of the picture. An overdose of sleeping tablets has become synonymous with suicide. Marilyn's case, I think, was simply an overdose of sleeping tablets. It's a terrible pity that so much beauty has been lost to us."
He was the youngest man ever elected president, and his youthful exuberance gave the nation a contagious spirit of freshness and vitality. From the moment he delivered his stirring inaugural address on a bright, cold January day in 1961, at about 12:30 on the afternoon of November 22nd, he was riding in an open convertible with his wife through downtown Dallas, waving to cheering crowds.
Here's another late development, and this news keeps coming in as we're talking here. President Kennedy, according to the Associated Press, and Texas Governor John Connally were shot from ambush today in Dallas, Texas, and it is not known whether either Mr. Kennedy or Governor Connally were killed. Both Mrs. Kennedy...
"We're canceling all regular formats during this emergency. All regular formats canceled. We'll continue to bring you news and bulletins. No commercial formats."
Here's other information just in from the correspondents traveling with the presidential party. It says President Kennedy apparently was shot in the head. The president...
"An important bulletin. President Kennedy was given blood transfusions just a few moments ago at Parkland Hospital in an effort to save his life."
While most Americans were not at home in front of their televisions that fateful Friday afternoon, CBS newsman Walter Cronkite earned his place in television history with a broadcast interruption that has become inextricably attached to the memory of that horrible event. At 2:38 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, his voice cracking, he delivered the shocking news.
"From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago."
The United States was a country founded in slavery, and one which, 100 years after slavery's official dissolution, remained half equal and half free. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was a pacifist, a spiritual man with a dream to eradicate injustice, and a brilliant tactician with a plan to make that dream come true. It was a plan which called for non-violent but unremitting resistance to racial discrimination in all its sanctioned forms. And it worked. Dr. King commanded respect and attention for a civil rights movement whose time was long overdue. He rallied support for the cause through masterful oratory and personal charisma. But mostly he did it through shining example. As Memphis, Tennessee, where he journeyed in April 1968 to lend support for a strike by that city's sanitation workers. It was there, standing on the balcony outside his room at the Lorraine Motel in the dimming sunlight that afternoon, that the 39-year-old Nobel Peace Prize winner made one final sacrifice for his cause.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot outside a Memphis motel this afternoon. His condition is not known at this time. Police put out a wanted bulletin for, quote, a young white male, well-dressed, who was seen running from a brick building across the street from the Lorraine Hotel. Police said the assailant apparently jumped into a late-model white car after the shooting and sped away.
Repeating that bulletin, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this evening, his condition not immediately known, but he was taken to a hospital. Lou Wood, NBC News, New York.
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was killed by a rifle bullet fired from a flophouse across the street by a drifter with a criminal record named James Earl Ray. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy had pledged that before the 60s were over, an American would walk on the moon.
Eagle looking great. Here go.
On July 20th, 1969, hundreds of millions of people around the world watched that dream come true. Three American astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, had helped to navigate a spaceship 240,000 miles from Earth to the moon.
Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent.
Auto descent.
Host control, both auto descent, engine command override off.
You're off.
Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, the Eagle has landed.
At 10:56 p.m. Eastern Time, Neil Armstrong descended from the space capsule and set foot on an airless, lifeless surface where no man had ever walked before.
I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Anchoring the coverage of the Apollo 11 mission for CBS was Walter Cronkite, the journalist the New York Times later called a one-man phenomenon in space coverage. But after 17 straight hours on the air, even Cronkite struggled to find the words to describe the extraordinary sight he was witnessing.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
Thank you. You're looking good here.
What?
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute. After I'm on, take care of the defense.
Wally, say something. I'm speechless.
I'm just trying to hold on to my breath. That is really something.
4 days later, completing a journey of extraordinary precision and magnitude, the capsule carrying the three astronauts fell safely back into the pull of Earth's gravity, where they were treated as conquering heroes. A global salute led by President Richard Nixon.
I was thinking, as you know, as you came down, and we knew it was a success, and it had only been 8 days, just a week, a long week, that this is the greatest week in the history of the world since the creation. Because as a result of what happened in this week, the world is bigger, infinitely, and also, as I'm going to find on this trip around the world, and as Secretary Rogers will find that he covers the other countries in Asia, As a result of what you've done, the world's never been closer together before. And we just thank you for that.
Theirs was the first successful trip to the moon and back. And there would be five more Apollo lunar missions to follow. On January 27, 1973, the U.S. signed a peace agreement in Paris, along with the governments of North and South Vietnam and the Viet Cong Provisional Military Government, after which American forces made a slow, final withdrawal from South Vietnam, a process President Richard Nixon called peace with honor. The end came quickly on April 30, 1975, and the nation watched the end on television as helicopters landed on the embassy roof and transported away the last American staff members and soldiers on duty, leaving behind hundreds of Vietnamese citizens within the embassy walls to meet an uncertain fate.
This is an NBC News hotline report. I'm Mike Moss. Communist forces reportedly have invaded Saigon in heavy street fighting in what appears to be the beginning of the final battle for the South Vietnamese capital. We have a report from NBC's Robert Wiener in Saigon.
Saigon came under attack about a half an hour after President Minh was sworn in at the presidential palace. Immediately after that, all sorts of firing broke out here in Saigon. Small arms fire, machine gun fire, rockets on the street. We've been pinned down here in the NBC office. It's been impossible for us to get down on the street level to see exactly what's happened.
That's NBC's Robert Wiener in Saigon. The communist forces appear to have invaded the South Vietnamese capital.
The rise of Elvis Presley in the 50s might have seemed, on the surface, to have more to do with sex than with music. He came to prominence at a moment when teenagers were growing in numbers and wielding economic clout, while technology made possible the mass medium in which his music could flourish. Transistor radios, portable record players, and, of course, television, where his good looks dazzled perhaps more than his voice. Elvis himself had no conscious political agenda, but he was altering the social consciousness of a generation by turning them on to the power and allure of music, which had sprung directly from black culture. And young white teenagers lapped it up. But by the 60s and 70s, he was overshadowed by more flamboyant and daring musical performers in the evolving musical culture. By August 16, 1977, he seemed more like an afterthought than a revolutionary figure. The man whose legend seemed much older than his 42 years.
Elvis Presley, dead at the age of 42. I'm John Meyer.
Elvis Presley died today at Baptist Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Presley was 42 years old. He parlayed a $4 visit to a recording studio into a multi-million dollar career. He was rushed to the hospital late this afternoon, suffering from what officials say was respiratory distress. The county medical examiner in Memphis, Dr. Jerry Francisca, says
the cause of the cardiac arrhythmia is not known at present time. It may never be known because there are several possible causes for cardiac arrhythmia, including high blood pressure and coronary artery disease, and he had both of those diseases. So either or both, acting together, might have been responsible.
Here in Washington, the White House issued a statement on the death of Presley. A report from Mutual News correspondent Duff Thomas.
In that statement, the president said Presley's music and personality, fusing the styles of white country and black rhythm and blues, permanently changed the face of American popular culture. He was a symbol to the people of the world over of the vitality, rebelliousness, and good humor of his country, unquote. The White House has no plans at this time for a day of national mourning. However, there's speculation that Presley's memory may someday be honored with a civilian medal for contributions to entertainment. Duff Thomas, the White House.
You're listening to The World Today.
Through his lyrics and peace-loving activism, John Lennon became more than a mere entertainer. The music of Lennon and his famed Beatles would form the soundtrack to a cultural revolution throughout the 60s. After the band's breakup in 1970, Lennon remained in the public eye as a successful solo act and vocal social activist. But in 1980, he would reemerge with a new album and a new passion for recording. He was returning from the studio when the unthinkable happened.
John Lennon was brought to the emergency room shortly before 11 p.m. He was dead on arrival.
Dr. Stephen Lynn of New York City's Roosevelt Hospital making the announcement that musician, composer, and former Beatle John Lennon is dead. Lennon was shot to death outside his New York apartment around 11 o'clock Eastern Time.
There were numerous wounds that entered the heart and the large vessels within the chest, causing a massive blood loss that could not be repaired or restored.
Dr. Lynn says Lennon suffered at least 7 gunshot wounds. Lennon was ambushed as he and his wife Yoko Ono were returning home from a recording session, allegedly by Hawaii native David Chapman.
And Mr. Chapman came up behind him and called to him, Mr. Lennon, as he arrived at that doorway. And then in a combat stance, he emptied the Charter Arms 38 caliber gun that he had with him and shot John Lennon.
Millions of Americans were seated comfortably in front of their televisions watching the New England Patriots battle the Miami Dolphins on ABC Television's Monday Night Football when commentator Howard Cosell interrupted the play-by-play with the tragic news.
In case the folks missed the earlier news flash, ABC News has confirmed that John Lennon, a member of the famed Beatles, maybe the best-known member, was shot twice in the back outside of his apartment building in the west side of New York tonight, rushed to the Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. An unspeakable tragedy. Details on Nightline 30 minutes after the end of this contest.
Lennon was fatally shot by a disturbed fan named Mark David Chapman, who just hours before had received Lennon's autograph on an album cover. We interrupt this broadcast.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast.
We interrupt this program to bring you a news bulletin from Washington.
Here is a news bulletin. Shots have reportedly been fired.
Here's another late development, and this news keeps coming in.
This is an NBC News hotline report.
It was a wall that literally split a city in two, dividing families from friends, east from west, and communism from capitalism. The Berlin Wall was erected in 1961 by an East German government determined to stop the mass exodus of its citizens into West Berlin, which was an oasis of democracy in otherwise communist East Germany. And it worked all too well. Then, on November 9, 1989, East Berlin officially announced that its borders to West Germany would be opened for private trips abroad, Within hours, thousands of jubilant citizens from both East and West Berlin began massing at the wall to celebrate. The end of the Berlin Wall was at hand.
Berlin's famous Freedom Bell rang out over the newly opened border.
I climbed over the wall and come and walk through the Brandenburg Gate.
I jumped over the wall. It's a great feeling.
I'm happy. I have been dreaming of this for years.
After 28 years, the East German government has thrown open the nation's prison-like Berlin Wall, and thousands of East and West Germans have been partying on the wall ever since, some chipping away at sections of the 20-mile-long wall.
I've just left Bernauerstrasse, where a crowd of perhaps 500 to 1,000 West Berliners are angrily protesting the Berlin Wall. I'm driving in an open car and was just subjected to a barrage of tear gas. At this point, it's too difficult to determine which side tossed the bombs, the East or the West Berliners.
President Bush, like many Americans, has been watching as East and West Germans test the open border.
I was moved, as you all were, by the pictures of Berliners from East and West standing atop the wall with chisels and hammers, celebrating the opening of the most vivid symbol of the Iron Curtain.
The next day, November 10th, 1989, the final demolition of the Berlin Wall began.